May it please the court, your honors, as I mentioned, Chris Kostolansky on behalf of DLV. I would like to try to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. In connection with this matter, your honor, Bronco and SureShock at all times had the ability to collect the entire amount of the mechanics lien from the DLV property. The public record regarding public ownership is readily available to all and provides everyone with the information that is necessary in order to file a mechanics lien. Exhibit B to DLV's motion for summary judgment attaches all of the deeds of trust and other relevant information to show the property ownership at the relevant time periods. Mr. Greenspan of SureShock accessed the public records, saw what units were being sold, was told that units were being sold, observed for himself that people were moving in. All SureShock and Bronco needed to do in order to perfect their lien with respect to all of the DLV property was to list DLV and the other unit owners, 22 in the case of SureShock and 14 in the case of Bronco, on the lien statement and serve a notice of lien pursuant to 109 subpart 3, and SureShock and Bronco would have been paid in full.
Mr. Kostolansky, what should a mechanical company do when pending sales don't close?
Well, that's not an issue here, Your Honor, with respect to
I understand that, but I mean, you do have to look with some foresight, and from the standpoint of someone who wants to lodge a lien, how are they to know?
Well, I think in that case, Your Honor, you would list both the existing owner and the reputed owner, which the statute expressly permits listing, and that potential purchaser then would be on notice as a reputed owner under the statute, and thus would receive notice of the lien.
Counsel, by the same token, can you tell us how DLV or DLV's successors were damaged when DLV had the best access to know how much of the units it still owned?
Well, Your Honor, it's not a question of what information DLV had access to, because compliance with the mechanics lien statute is placed upon the mechanical contracting company, because they are the ones seeking the benefit of a statute in derogation of the common law. Issues concerning the creation of the lien, according to the case law, are to be strictly construed. Issues concerning the remedial aspects are construed more liberally. Thus, the obligation for compliance lies with the mechanical contractor. And here, we're not talking about anything that was difficult to find. Information regarding ownership of these units was in the public record. The sales had closed before the mechanics liens were filed, and if there were any issues regarding that, as Judge Graham observes, then they could file a lien covering both if they had notice from the public record of a pending sale. So it's not something that's really the burden of the owner. It's the burden of the mechanical contractor seeking to fall within the statute, as opposed to prosecuting common law claims for breach of contract.
Counsel, it seems to me that your group of clients is effectively making the argument that was made at the trial level in the Compass Bank case versus Brickman, which, you know, subsequently this court disagreed with, and ultimately the Supreme Court also rejected. How is the argument different?
Well, Your Honor, we're not arguing the Compass Bank involved an issue of strict construction with respect to filing a blanket lien with respect to all of the property. They filed it with respect to less than all of the property. Judge Bender in dissent argued for strict construction requiring all of the property be named. But here we're dealing with a different aspect of the statute. We're not dealing with the 103.4 aspect with respect to a blanket lien, except concerning good faith. What we're dealing here at the outset with is 109 subpart 1, which concerns the obligation to list the owner or reputed owner of the property, and then to describe the property with a sufficient basis to identify the property to the exclusion of others. And that was something that SureShock and Bronco both readily could have done, because the information available to them in the public record set forth who the owners of the property were.
Mr. Kostolansky, I don't mean to beat a dead horse here, but I am interested in your explaining to me how a non-owner can be a reputed owner.
Well, they're a reputed owner in the sense that they may become an owner at some juncture in the future.
Isn't that the universe of people?
Well, but it would be the situation you were positing, Your Honor, was a situation where there was a contract entered into to close on a property, but yet the property had not closed. And you were asking me in that situation, how could a mechanics lien contractor protect himself if he was aware of that?
Okay, accepting that. How about people who have not contracted?
Well, if they have not contracted, then they're not an owner, and then their interest would come later after the lien was filed, and they would be acquiring the property subject to the lien, which is, in that circumstance, that's exactly what the mechanics lien statute is attempting to address, to provide notice through the statutory requirements so that when future owners acquire the property, they acquire, you know, with notice of the proper state of the record.
Recognizing that, isn't the test for whether an encumbrance will cloud a property the date of closing? Isn't that what your title insurance covers?
Well, no, Your Honor, I don't think the date of closing is necessarily...
Well, deed transfer.
Yeah, I think the point here is that once there's a cloud in the title, that, you know, once that's in place, that's going to continue on to future purchasers. So by virtue of the lien being filed in this case, individuals who may purchase in the future would have to have the issue of the cloud addressed. So if I purchased, if I had closed like one of the unit owners did, and then Bronco and SureShock filed this lien, that would be creating a cloud on my title. And what we're saying is that since the mechanics lien statute requires the mechanics lien claimant to identify the owner and identify the property sufficiently to cover the lien claims, that when they file a lien that they know is beyond the property that's owned by the owner, namely the 7 units the DLV owned, that is bad from a societal standpoint because it creates clouds on people's title, and it's something that can easily be rectified by simply looking at the public record. And once one looks at the public record, they see who the owners are, then you file the lien claim identifying all of the owners, which is not a very difficult burden to satisfy at all, and then you have properly perfected your lien with respect to all claims. But when you file a lien without providing, without identifying those owners and giving them the requisite notice under the statute, then you create a cloud on their title. They don't have a mechanism but for getting involved in litigation to remove that cloud.
Now, so, counsel, I don't think your briefing adequately explains this, and maybe you can explain it now. I can see where the individuals who purchase might come before this court and try to claim that, but what standing does DLV have to assert that claim on their behalf?
We're not asserting a claim, Your Honor, on their behalf. What we're doing is addressing the issue of the enforceability of the mechanics lien statute. So, for example, if we look at the Everett Lumber case that dealt with Section 109.3, and that required that an affidavit of service be served on the owner. That wasn't done. The court had to address the issue of whether that failure to comply with that statutory requirement of the mechanics lien rendered the lien invalid. The court held that it did render the lien invalid because the statute is subject to strict construction. And even though in Everett Lumber, the owner had actual notice of the lien, the court held that the lien was void because it did not comply with the statutory requirements for the creation of a lien that are to be strictly construed. And that's what we're saying with respect to Section 109.1 regarding ownership of the property and the description of the property, that those sections are to be strictly construed. Here, SureShock identified DLV as the owner. It said in its briefing, and this is even in its appellate brief at page 12, though SureShock filed the SureShock lien against the entire project, it has always sought to enforce the lien only against the DLV units. So when you seek to enforce a lien against the 7 units that are owned by DLV, and that information is readily obtainable from the public record, you don't file a lien that creates clouds on title for 22 other property owners. And when you do, that creates issues regarding the enforceability of the lien and the failure to comply with the statutory requirements in 109.1 in order to create the lien.
Why doesn't the trial court's ability to apportion the lien accordingly to, you know, based on the then owned units, why doesn't that resolve the issue?
Well,
it seems to me that that's what effectively what the Compass Bank court advocated.
Well, Compass Bank, Your Honor, dealt with the enforceability of a lien that had already satisfied the elements of Section 109.1 in the language of the court, because there Compass Bank dealt with a finite number of lien claimants because the lien had been released as to certain portions of the property but not released as to others. So Compass Bank dealt with a situation in which the lien did not seek to lien the property of others, but it only sought to lien the property that was subject to the lien, namely these 3 remaining units in Compass Bank that had not been released. So it was not a situation where they sought to lien property of other people. Here the lien in this case went out to property of other people, and that creates a societal ill, and therefore since the property was not properly described in the lien statement, the lien should be void. So in Compass Bank, the apportionment caused the lien to only be enforced to the extent that the 3 units that were subject to the lien benefited. And there's nothing wrong with that. There was no overreaching, no societal harm created by that underleaning of property. That could be the choice of the lien holder, to lien less than all the property. But here, when you lien property that's not owned by the person who you're asserting a lien against, that creates a societal ill that doesn't comply with the statute, which requires that you identify the owners and identify the property specific to the subject of the lien. And here, they went beyond that with respect to 22 units for DLV, or I'm sorry, for SureShock, and 14 units with respect to Bronco. So the question then, you know, facing this court is whether the court wants to sanction as technical compliance with the requirements of Section 109.1 an act that creates a lien on other people's property when at the time the lien was filed, the lien holder specifically identified the owner and said they were only seeking to enforce the lien against 7 units, as I quoted from their brief. But instead, they listed 30 units. That creates problems with respect to enforceability of the lien, and that's something that should not be enforceable. And then as to the issue of good faith, if the lien were enforceable under Section 109.1, then we reach the issue of whether it can be enforced as a blanket lien, which according to the case law can only be filed in good faith. And that's both the ITC case, the Berger case, and Compass Bank all refer to good faith. And in this case, there, as a matter of law, there cannot be good faith in filing a lien that overreaches and seeks to cover property of owners who are not identified in the mechanics lien and creates a cloud on their title.
And of course, the trial court here determined that there wasn't a lack of good faith.
Well, I don't know that the trial court determined that the lien was enforceable, and they rejected our argument with respect to that. But we bring this matter on appeal, Your Honor, because this is a question of law. This is not something that's subject to an abuse of discretion standard of review. If there's been a situation where someone has overly described the property, then that is something that that should not be rendered enforceable, because by definition it can't be in good faith.
Let me ask you, you left me at the station on that. When you say that this is not discretionary, it's bad faith as a matter of law, what you're saying to me, what I'm hearing you say, is that we look at this issue de novo.
Yes.
How can we possibly look at this issue de novo when we don't have a witness stand over there?
Because there are no facts in dispute. Because a lien was filed that described attempted to reach property and did reach property that was not owned by the owner listed. And when you attempt to reach property that you admit that the owner does not own, that is a lack of good faith. Because by definition, you're placing a cloud on title of people who do not own the property.
Do you have a case that says a blanket lien is per se bad faith?
No, I don't. No, I don't, Your Honor. And a blanket lien, in fact, can be fine if you're seeking to cover all the property and then later apportion. But they're not seeking to cover all the property. They have said they sought to enforce it only against the 7 DLV owned units, which is I quoted from their brief. And when you seek to only enforce against 7 units and you lien as to 30 or lien as to 29, that is bad faith, because you're tying up someone else's property who doesn't have an ownership interest. Your Honor, if I could briefly address the issues concerning section 109 subpart 3, that concerns an attempt to file a lien, an amended lien. Here the lien statement was filed on October 17 at 12:35 p.m. The amended lien statement was filed on October 17, 2007, 1 minute later. And in the Everett case, Your Honor, notes very clearly that one needs to comply strictly with the requirements of notice, and the notice was not complied with in this case. The application of 109.3 applies to, quote, any lien, close quote, in the statute. And in this case, there was an intent by the other side to amend 1 minute later and thereby avoid giving the owner notice of the amount of the lien. The amount of the lien increased 30% in that 1 minute. The owner's entitled to notice. The trial court said, well, he knew that people were working on the project, but even if you know people are working on the project, that's true in every mechanics lien case. And the point here is to comply with the notice statute and give the owner notice of precisely what the lien amount is. So we would say, Your Honor, that Everett does not permit that, and I will save the balance of my time. Thank you,
Mr. Koslowski.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Jonathan Allen, and I'm here on behalf of who we refer to as the loft defendants. These are the owners and lenders for the individual units at the Diamond Lofts project. Mr. Kostolansky has already addressed a number of issues that would support invalidating both the SureShock and Bronco liens as a matter of law. I'd like to focus on two different issues. First, the trial court applied the incorrect legal standard when it held that the Loft defendants were required to prove quote-unquote guilty knowledge with respect to their excessiveness defense under the CRS 3822-128. And second, in the event the court cannot conclude as a matter of law that the Bronco mechanics lien is invalid, we'd submit that the trial court abused its discretion when it did not allow the Loft defendants to conduct discovery before going to trial on the Bronco's mechanics lien. With respect to the first issue, the excessive lien statute under CRS 3822-128 really provides for three elements in order to prove that a lien is excessive and therefore void under the mechanics lien statute. Those elements are that a lien is filed for an amount greater than is due, without a reasonable possibility that the amount claimed is due, and with knowledge that the amount claimed is greater than the amount due. Here, when the trial court ruled on the issue, it held that the Loft defendants had not proven quote-unquote guilty knowledge and thus had not proven their excessiveness defense under the statute.
Is that the same as knowingly wrongful?
I don't believe so. How do they differ? Well, the statute requires that a claimant knowingly file an excessive lien, but it does not require any wrongful intent. And I think the Byerly case is instructive, Your Honor. In Byerly, the trial court found that the lien was not excessive because the lien claimant had a reasonable good faith belief that the amounts would someday become due. The Court of Appeals reversed the trial court and found that in light of the information that was available to the lien claimant at the time the lien was filed, there was only two possibilities. One, that the full lien amount was not then due to the contractor. And two, that the contractor knew that when he filed his lien. The Byerly court didn't address whether there was any wrongful intent to defraud, intent to cheat, anything like that. It was just that he knew that the lien amount was not then owed. This case is no different with respect to Bronco. At the time Bronco filed its lien, it was undisputed that the amount stated in the lien of approximately $21,000 overstated what was then due to Bronco by about $3,000.
Counsel, why shouldn't we defer to the, regardless of the language that the court used, why shouldn't we defer to the trial court's, effectively making a factual determination that, the right hand wasn't speaking with the right hand, and that in filing the lien, the attorney made a mistake. He just had not ascertained the then due amount, which he later said, yes, it's a mistake, and we're only seeking the amount that's actually due.
Well, I'd first point out that the Wingham court specifically held that a subsequent reduction in the amount of the lien during the course of litigation can't fix the fact that a lien was filed for an amount, an excessive amount. And we're not asking this court to disturb any findings of the trial court. I think the trial court's findings and the evidence presented are undisputed here. First, that the amount stated in lien overstated what was due. And second, Bronco had credited to its own account that payment had come in before the lien was recorded.
But it seems to me that the requirement is more that more than the amount is, you're not entitled to that amount at the time you file the lien. In other words, it's a bit like deceit. You make a statement, and when you make the statement, you know it's not true. As I understand the court's findings here, he used the term guilty knowledge to come to a finding that at the time the lien was filed, there wasn't knowledge that that amount was not due.
Well, to I'm not, I think what the trial court focused on was that Bronco didn't intend to cheat or defraud or mislead. Now, that's not the standard that is set forth in 128, I don't believe. There's case law dealing with the predecessor statute to 128, section 123, which focuses more on intent. The statute 128 focuses specifically on what was known. And here, there's really only two conclusions that can be drawn, which is that Bronco itself knew that the amount was overstated. It knew that when it recorded the $3,000 and change payment to its account, and went ahead and recorded the lien, and I think most importantly, took no steps to correct the record. The lien that still exists out there has an amount stated of $21,000. There's any number of things that Bronco could have done, file a reduction of lien, an amended lien statement to correct the public records, but none of those things was done in this case. The second point I'd like to address quickly, Your Honor, is that when the loft defendants went to trial on the Bronco's mechanics lien issue, they did so without the benefit of any discovery. Now, I think this is particularly important with respect to the excessive lien issue, because the lack of discovery really precluded the loft defendants from delving into some of the very issues that you've raised regarding who knew what and when Bronco knew and what its intentions were when that lien was recorded. I believe we've cited cases in our briefs that because discovery can significantly impact a party's rights, the discovery rules are to be liberally construed, and regardless of the burden of proof, a party is entitled to complete discovery in order to adequately prepare his case.
So you would disagree with Mr. Kostolansky. Under your view, Mr. Allen, you do have factual determinations to delve into the question of what the court determined to be guilty knowledge, whereas Mr. Kostolansky takes the view that something can be, as a matter of law, a bad faith.
Well, I think the two issues are different here, and I don't necessarily disagree with Mr. Kostolansky, and particularly the issues he's raising with respect to Sureshock's lien. The parties had the benefit of discovery when they went to trial on Sureshock's lien. With respect to Bronco, there was no discovery that was granted to allow, even to the extent that guilty knowledge is a proper standard to be applied, which we would submit that it's not, the loft defendants needed the benefit of discovery to delve into those issues. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we don't know exactly what evidence would have been turned up because we weren't given any right to do discovery. And the court in the Tuscany case, which we've cited in our briefs, wasn't willing to treat the trial court's error to deny discovery as harmless in that context, saying that there's no way that the court can know what discovery would have turned up from a factual standpoint. So it's not harmless error to be forced to proceed to trial without the benefit of any discovery whatsoever.
But aren't your clients' rights effectively the same rights that DLV would have and derivative of those? So how would you be entitled to different or additional discovery than DLV was?
Well, Your Honor, the loft defendants have an interest in the real property that's subject to the litigation, would have a right to intervene into the, or could at the very least intervene upon the trial court's discretion into the lawsuit, which is effectively what happened in this case. And as the current owners of the property, certainly the loft defendants have a different and perhaps greater interest in defending their property rights. So I'd submit that the discovery that we would do, while our property rights may be derivative of Diamond Lofts, the interest in pursuing those rights and defending those rights is not the same. Unless there are any further questions, I'll reserve the balance of our time.
Thank you, Mr. Allen.
Thank you.
Ms. Karamalagos, is that close?
Karamalagos, yes, Your Honor, yes. I think my maiden name was easier to pronounce. So.
Smith.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Carmelagos Coast, registration number 34720, and I'm here today representing Sureshock and Bronco in these appeals. I'd like to start out by first emphasizing the fact that these mechanics liens were filed over 7 years ago. DLV has, for the last 7 years, at every possible opportunity and every procedural avenue, attempted to avoid payment of a debt that is owed to Sureshock. We're not here today to discuss the amounts owed to Sureshock and to Bronco, because those amounts have been determined in several proceedings prior to today, leading up to this. There have been two arbitrations, there have been two trials, a previous appeal, and now the three appeals before you. Sureshock and Bronco, I'll represent, are the innocent parties in this situation. With respect, if it pleases the court, I'd like to discuss the mechanics lien issues first with respect to what Mr. Kostolansky brought up, and I will go to the loft defendants afterwards. But Mr. Kostolansky and the DLV appellants would have the court essentially require that Sureshock and Bronco have brought in all the innocent purchasers prior to the lien in order to have an effective lien in this case. 109(1)(c) doesn't require that. The language specific to 109(1)(c) states that the description of the property, the statement of the lien, must contain a description of property charged with the lien sufficient to identify the same. I think that Judge Hoffman put it well during the Bronco trial when he stated the General Assembly itself, by using the word sufficient in the statute, is acknowledging that the description of the property doesn't have to be perfect. It has to be sufficient. There's no requirement for exact specificity in the statute. Sureshock and Bronco named the owner that they were seeking to enforce a lien against, and identified the property upon which the owner owned the property that it was seeking to seeking its lien against and to enforce its lien against. We were only ever attempting to collect against DLV, that's correct. Appellants have discussed in their briefing that, well, one thing I'd like to discuss first, actually, is a point that was addressed earlier, that Sureshock had knowledge. Sureshock should have known. Bronco should have known who the property owners were. I think the court was right on point in addressing that issue specifically. There is a delay in recording in the statute. It is unknown, potentially, and Sureshock and Bronco could have left certain unit owners out that were possibly under contract, had not recorded their transactions yet. In this situation, the only way to have been able to do what appellants now ask is if we had prepared a lien that excluded certain property. But again, that would have potentially left out units, and we would have been in the situation, the same situation potentially we are here today, with DLV arguing on behalf of unit owners that aren't DLV, that the lien is invalid. And I will represent it's because it's an avoidance of payment of this valid amount that's owed to them.
Counsel, your opponent insists that your clients should have also included all the property owners. But on what basis would either Sureshock, Bronco, or both of them have had a valid lien against property owners that purchased without knowledge that these liens were being asserted?
Your Honor, that's a good question. We were never trying to do that because we don't feel like we could have asserted a valid lien against unit owners that took title prior to our lien.
You didn't have a contract with them, right?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. Sureshock had asked DLV, and this is part of the factual record, Sureshock had asked DLV on numerous occasions what units had been sold. It was trying to, it was trying to communicate with DLV to obtain this information, but that was not provided. You can find that in the court's order at CD 9388, the validity and apportionment order, Your Honors, or with the Doug Greenspan affidavit at CD 7421.
DLV wasn't obligated to tell you that.
It was not. But I think it shows some sort of, and the court actually addressed this issue, it shows some sort of malicious intent to prevent SureShock from doing this properly, from filing a lien the way they now claim we should have.
Well, malicious intent or just savvy business? They're not required to disclose to somebody who wants to lien the property who owns what. Aren't they entitled to expect that you'll address the records just like anyone else would?
They are entitled to inspect. It would have certainly avoided the situation where we are today and avoided the situation where there were contractual units that we were not aware of. The court has addressed in Carrie Hardwell, where, Your Honors, that under the definition sufficient to identify a property, there is wide latitude allowed. This is not a de novo situation. There's factual situations in each case that must be reviewed. If I hadn't, to the extent that Mr. Kosolansky and the DLV defendants propose that this is a de novo standard of review, I don't believe it is, based on the case law. In fact, let's move to the blanket lien issue quickly as well. If you're looking at good faith as proposed by Mr. Kosolansky, I think the court hit the issue clearly in that it is a factual determination to be made on the blanket lien issue. This is not a de novo standard of review here either. And the court did look at the behavior of the parties and the factual scenario that occurred prior to filing the lien in determining whether the blanket lien, if that is what we're discussing, was appropriate. Appellants claim the liens are invalid and inappropriate because they are filed as a blanket lien. But again, we filed our lien to attach to the owners only, the only owner, DLV, who we were seeking to execute our lien against, and on the property owned by it there. DLV promised to pay based on sales. One of the situations that occurred here is we released our initial lien because we were promised, SureShock and Bronco were promised, that sales proceeds would come to DLV, or would come to SureShock. So we released the first lien. Only $7,000 was received in the interim, despite hundreds of thousands of dollars being obtained by DLV based on these sales. In filing our lien after this, we were trying to prevent future sales and collect against DLV. What DLV did then, once the lien was filed, was convince a title insurance company to insure over the properties. This is not common on a $600-some-thousand-dollar lien, but it convinced Fidelity Insurance, a title company, to insure over it. So under those circumstances, the purchasers were covered, but DLV has guaranteed it. Now, DLV is claiming, of course, that despite these actions, it's still not entitled, or SureShock is still not entitled to its lien. I think Compass does make clear that blanket liens are valid, depending on the circumstances of each case. In this circumstance, if we are going to look at this as a blanket lien, I don't believe that Compass Bank prevents the court from allowing SureShock to obtain the full portion of its lien, which I will address in discussions with regard to our cross appeal. What I want to touch upon quickly as well is the 1093 argument that was addressed by Mr. Kosolansky, and that was with respect to the affidavit and that the notice requirements weren't strictly complied with. Now, Mr. Kosolansky raised the case of Everett
to support his position. In Everett, however, there was no affidavit filed at all. There was no affidavit served at all. There is no dispute here that there was a valid and perfected lien with respect to the initial lien. So there were two liens filed on October 17th. The first was the renewed lien based on the prior, and the second dealt with the amended amount. That was done, but DLV, as the owner that we were seeking recourse against, received that notice. The trial court found that, as a matter of fact, at trial, that DLV had notice of the amended lien as well. I know that there was some argument that it did not, but the factual finding of the court stated that it did. Mr. Kostolansky attempts to create a good faith obligation, and again, that addresses the standard by which the court should review the 103-4 and the remainder of the statutory provisions. However, again, we'll submit that it is not a de novo standard of review. The trial court here acknowledged that requiring a claimant in situations such as this to amend to file new notices of intent, new 10-day notices of intent, would not be a practical, it's not required under the statutory scheme of the mechanics lien, and it wouldn't be practical. There are situations clearly that happen all the time where contractors continue to work after an initial lien is filed. To require them every time an amount owed is increased to submit a new 10-day notice of intent is not what the statute was designed to accomplish. I'd like to also briefly address some of the loft defendants' arguments, Your Honors, at this time, if I may. The first being that the Bronco lien was excessive. Mr. Allen himself, in listing out the three points that are required to find an excessive lien, stated that it required knowledge greater than the amount due was actually filed. So I respectfully submit that the standard applied by the trial court, guilty knowledge, says just that. You're doing something you know is wrong. You're filing an amount you know is wrong. In this circumstance, the factual finding by the court was he didn't. That the Bronco did not file the lien with guilty knowledge that it was in excess of the amount owed. And in any event, the contract or the complaint that was filed subsequent to the lien shows the amount that was actually owed and wasn't seeking to enforce the amount that was on the amended lien. And when the complaint is filed, the list pendants is also included in that list, case, which directs any party to the complaint and shows that the amount is what it is, $17,000 versus the $21,000.
Counsel, your opponent makes a good point that Bronco could have easily amended. So why didn't that happen?
Your Honor, they did not believe that that was necessary at the time, given the complaint was filed, and to perfect the lien and the amount, the complaint must be filed. So a list pendants given with the complaint corrected that in their minds. Also, Your Honors, with respect to the excessive lien issue, we would ask for attorney's fees. Under the statute, we're entitled to that. With respect to the discovery issue, the loft defendants, it's questionable whether the loft defendants even had standing to be in the initial lawsuit to begin with. They took property after the lien was filed. They took title to the property after the lien was filed.
And didn't your clients bring them in?
Well, we brought them in at the court's recommendation, Your Honor, so that they would be knowledgeable with regard to the proceedings and what was happening with their properties in the future. They were entitled to participate in the litigation. They received, although they're claiming, the quote I believe from Mr. Allen was without the benefit of discovery.
they received all the documents, all of the discovery that was submitted to all of the parties in this underlying action that DLV had, that SureShock had. And as the court rightfully pointed out, it's DLV that was, it was actually DLV's cause of action to be addressing, and they sufficiently covered everything at issue. At trial, the excessive lien issue was addressed. Every issue, we failed today to even know what potentially the loft defendants claim they didn't have, or they weren't an offer of proof or anything to show that there was any evidence that they could have used that was not provided to them that would have changed anything. So in that regard, we believe even if discovery should have been provided to them, it was harmless error, Your Honors. Lastly, I'd like to discuss our cross appeal, the apportionment issue. DLV acknowledges that the only issues for the trial court in its opening brief, that the only issues the trial court was supposed to address was the validity of the lien, the property to which it applied, and the apportionment of that lien. The amount of the lien, as we discussed, was not an issue. The court's apportionment has reduced SureShock's lien to approximately a third of what the prior arbitration, the trial court, and the appellate court in the preceding matters determined was the amount owed to SureShock. Compass, I believe, stands for the proposition that an entire lien amount can be recovered from a single property as long as the debtor holds the sole interest in all the properties being benefited under the contract.
But here there were many more properties that were benefited that had the benefit of Bronco and SureShock's materials and work. So why shouldn't the court have done what it did, which is an allocation based on square footage?
Yes, and initially, DLV was the only owner of the entire project. Subsequently, there were purchasers that purchased properties here, but it was owned at one time when SureShock and Bronco were performing their work, the majority of their work, owned by DLV. The Compass Court cited also the First National Bank in Fort Collins versus Sam McClure for the same proposition. Compass stands for the proposition that equity should dictate how, if at all, an apportionment should be done. Under the circumstances, you look to the contract. The contract price here was $1.6 million. If we are looking at how each unit benefited from the contract price, we can't look at just the lien amount. We have to look at the contract price. Each unit, based on the court's apportionment, the court looked at square footage and determined that it was 33% with the assistance of the parties that was now being sought to base for the foreclosure proceedings. 33% of the total contract price amounts to approximately $548,000, Your Honors. That is almost $400,000 more than what the court has awarded. Essentially, in looking to equity to assist in determining how this should be apportioned, if at all, you must look on a case-by-case basis. Here, if the court's analysis and interpretation of apportionment is maintained, SureShock will lose $400,000 of its contractual amount that it is entitled to receive based on the work it performed and the services it provided to DLV. DLV now seeks to be unjustly enriched by that $400,000 on the technicalities it presents to the court.
Why is apportionment on the basis of the lien inequitable?
For one of the reasons, Your Honor, I just discussed, $400,000 of SureShock's work performed will not be recovered.
Well, I assume that the judge could have taken the position here that you had a chance. A lot of owners took free and clear title. And so the fact that they walked without paying you doesn't make it inequitable, does it, that the lien is apportioned among the remaining people who are subject to the lien?
Your Honor, the remaining people should at least, all of the units should be given the same amount of value based on the contract price, not what's remaining on the lien. If you don't do it that way, then some of the other properties that had been sold benefit more from the work that was done than the properties now at issue.
But isn't that the risk of waiting to file the lien? You know, SureShock filed after Bronco, and so, I mean, presumably could have filed before Bronco.
But that still would have left many properties sold and our lien outstanding and in the same place we are today, Your Honor. I submit. Here, the most logical and I believe fair conclusion, if apportionment is to be granted on an equitable basis, would be to provide SureShock with the entire lien amount, because it's only approximately $40,000 more than what apportionment on the contract basis would have been. We're dealing with commercial units who are potentially more utilized than the other units, the residential units, and potentially obtained more benefit. And so from an equitable perspective, it is permitted under Colorado law to allow SureShock the entirety of its lien. But if not, we would ask the court to do it on the contract basis using the court's analysis of 33.1%. In conclusion here, Your Honors, may I just say that SureShock and Bronco performed work that it didn't get paid for. That's why we're here. DLV has presented arguments that owners were potentially harmed. DLV hasn't shown how it was harmed. DLV owes this money and is taking every avenue to prevent payment. SureShock has unfortunately had to go bankrupt as a result of these actions, has gone out of business as a result of DLV's actions in failing to pay the amounts owed. The purpose of the statute, the mechanics lien statutes, are to benefit and protect those who supply services that enhance the value of another's property. DLV was able to benefit from SureShock's work. SureShock was not. The statute is not meant to deprive contractors of the right to be paid for those services. We hope that you see things the way the courts have for the last 7 years in this litigation, and I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may, for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Karmeligas. And Mr. Kostolansky?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'll address issues concerning apportionment first. And their Compass Bank, Your Honors, is very clear that apportionment should apply only to the extent that each unit actually benefited from the work performed under the contract. And that's precisely the type of analysis that Judge Eliff went through in addressing apportionment. His decision should be reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard, and there's clearly no abuse of discretion there. I want to address, Your Honors, the question that Judge Fox raised about, whether would the other property owners need to have a contract with the construction, the folks providing the construction services, in order for there to be a lien. The answer to that is no, because a lien attaches to the property. Notice is to be provided to the owners, but the lien itself attaches to the property. Thus, one of the options SureShock had was to bring in all of the individual property owners and therefore recover for all the services it provided that benefited those units, and its lien would have been proper under 109.1 had they done so. The other option.
Do you have any authority for that proposition, counsel?
That's the statute, Your Honor, and because the statute says you file a lien against property for work performed that benefited that property, and you identify the owners when you're seeking to utilize the statute. And so that's what would have occurred here had they identified the other owners. The other option, since you're simply seeking to file a lien against DLV, is to simply look at the record and only lien the property that's owned by DLV. Those were two options, and had they taken either of those options, the lien itself would have been enforceable because there would have been no cloud on title, there would have been no overreaching, there would have been no misdescription of the property. But that's not what occurred here.
Thank you, Mr. Koslansky.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Carmelagos. Carmelagos. I'm going to get this right before the end of the day.
Carmelagos, Your Honor. Just briefly, I want to hit a couple points. Cloud is lifted on title when a complaint is filed. There is no unit owner that has purchased prior to the lien that has come forward with any issues. All the units were benefited, that's true. Our client filed a lien only against DLV and the DLV units that were owned by DLV at the time the lien was filed. It never sought to... That, to our client, was the attempt to be clear with regard to, it's not naming, it's not seeking to enforce a lien against all of the unit owners. It is simply against DLV. We recorded our lien. We filed our lien only against DLV. We attempted to maintain only against DLV until it was raised by the court that the loft defendants should join so that they are aware of the proceedings. But Your Honor, again, Your Honors, I submit that SureShock is entitled to be paid for the amounts owed to it, and Colorado law supports that position.
Thank you, Ms. Carmelagos. I'm assuming that completes arguments on both sides at this point. Thank you again, Mr. Koslansky, Mr. Allen. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect written opinions in all three of these matters to issue in due course.